One of the best red wine values in Italian wine right now is the Valdiba Dolcetto from Sanferrolo. I'm a huge fan of this wine for how it combines drinkability with nuance and complexity, and also the value for the money is outrageous. You can get few wines of this quality for this price from anywhere in the world. Here's an example of what I mean. Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan will offer you a discount on the 2013 Valdiba Dolcetto from Sanferrolo, so that the price comes down to $15.95 a bottle for listeners of this show. $15.95 a bottle. That's it. Which is really amazing for the quality of the wine. If you want an amazing deal in red wine, this is it. Call Crush at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTTFORME, or use that same promo code online at crushwineco.com to make your purchase and to get your discount. You can also send me an email at levyopenswine@gmail.com if you want to join our wine club, and we'll set aside some terrific Dolcetto specifically for you. I'll drink to that, where we get into wine one person at a time. I'm your host, Levy Dalton. The show warm-ups are provided by Aaron Scala, and together we go behind the scenes of the beverage business.
What makes one grape variety better than another? This is a good question to keep in mind as we watch the dynamic wine world change over the next several decades. It's also a question to keep an open mind about. I imagine we all have our own personal hierarchy of grape varieties, and for centuries, the notion that one grape variety is supreme to another has shaped entire economies. People with political power, kings in particular, and more recently presidents, have long pushed their personal drinking preferences on the regions under their control. Louis XIV, he really liked Burgundy. Thomas Jefferson imported Bordeaux to the Americas. The Tsars were into bubbly champagne. And Philip the Bold hated Gamay so much that he banished it because he found it to be evil. Gamay has a different place on my hierarchy of favorite grape varieties. And in much of the EU today, American grape material is forbidden. Well, just the Scion part of it. Over the centuries, grape hierarchies have been determined and driven by differing agendas. The grower's perspective often differs from the drinker's perspective. In particular, when a region is dominated by large buyers who purchase fruit from smaller growers, the way those growers are paid will affect which grape varieties become prominent. For instance, if they're paid by weight, growers will likely opt for higher-yielding varieties. But if they're paid by sugar content, better-ripening grapes may become more popular, as opposed to higher-acid grapes. This was the story for Graciano in Rioja, a high-acid grape which is making a resurgence today. In estate wineries, the easier varieties to grow might become the most popular. Especially in regions that deal with tough climates, grape varieties that give you a consistent yield year in and year out, and grape varieties that are resistant to your local climate issues and local pests will usually end up being more popular. Growers are also looking at rootstocks. Unless we're vineyard managers, we're probably not paying enough attention to rootstocks. These are definitely some genetic species and varieties that are experiencing a heavy surge of propagation because they're better on limestone or better at controlling vigor. So from the rootstock angle, some varieties are more useful on certain terroirs than others, and thus they experience some popularity. And there's also the cultural angle. Regional definition and regional expectations for consumers drive some of grape variety popularity. Many wine regions set up boards to govern the quality of their region. This has become increasingly popular since the early 1900s. There are often some stipulations about allowable grape varieties. Some of the regional wine boards limit what their region can produce so that their region's products have a clear identity to the larger global market. But sometimes there are ways around these limitations. There are ways of growing disavowed grape varieties. For instance, you can declassify the grapes to the larger region. Like, if you're growing Cabernet Franc in Savinier, you can't call it Savinier. You have to declassify to Anjou Rouge. Then, of course, there's what's probably the biggest force of all in determining grape varieties, the market. If a particular grape variety is getting twice the price of all others, or more, it's a no-brainer that slowly the region will migrate to the most lucrative grape. All of these factors influence regional regulating boards who, when creating the rules, they need to strike a balance between a grape variety's ability to grow successfully in the region, the economic success in the market, the cultural importance of the grape, and the elusive and subjective notion of quality. So regulating boards are working hard to negotiate all of these things. But what happens when things get extremely specific? The limitations on who can make what, where, when, at which sugar levels, and what alcohol, and from which specific genetic grape material, it's becoming more and more narrow. In a way, this is good because this allows us to focus in on regional expectations. The less varied a region's products are, the more we know what to expect from that region. But several centuries from now, will limiting wine regions to a few grape varieties have taken its toll? By not allowing natural selection and a healthy amount of biodiversity, are we setting ourselves up for monoculture failure? And it's here that we enter into the paradox. On one hand, we need to govern quality. But sometimes, in the act of governing, we reduce quality. By choosing certain grape varieties, you're automatically dismissing others, some that might have a heavy presence in the region, or that theoretically could be great for the region. And sometimes governing boards, in their promotion of quality, allow grapes, but paint them pejoratively as workhorses or as quaffable wines of the region, while giving other grapes all the glory. The narrative is often repeated until it becomes absorbed into the fabric of culture. But what happens when a wine producer diverges from the narrative? What happens when someone makes great wine from the grape variety that is supposed to be the region's simple wine? What will you think of an amazing Aligoté, a sublime Côte du Rhône, a really good Super Tuscan? How do you fit awesome and serious Dolcetto into the narrative of Piedmonte wine? Wines like these beg for a fluid notion of grape variety and quality. Keep listening to hear more from one producer who makes us rethink our hierarchy of grape varieties with exceptional and serious wines from a grape that many people consider quotidien.
Hi, I'm Mike Van Byer from Bottles Beverage in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm the wine director.
I'm Cappy Pete Chapman, the director of beverage and education for Neighborhood Dining Group in Charleston, South Carolina.
Chris Dooley, sommelier at L'Espalier, Boston, Massachusetts.
Take it from these buyers. 750 has become the modern resource for restaurants, retailers, and bars all across the country. 750 gives buyers access to detailed wholesale pricing, a calendar of upcoming trade tastings, and seamless connections to their sales reps. Sign up today for free at 750.com. That's 750.com spelled out. Nicolette Bocca of Sanferrolo in Doliani on the show. Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Very nice to see you. So you actually used to be in the fashion business.
Yes, I used to. Because when I started working, I started with university. I was studying philosophy. But at a certain point, I needed to earn my money. And I started to work in a press office of Giorgio Armani. My mother and my father were journalists. She used to write about fashion. And so she introduced me in the fashion world, and I started to work there. And then after some time, I started to be interested in something that was not so close to my parents' job. And I started studying the history of contemporary fashion, how Italian prêt-à-porter developed, and was very interesting. And then I started to work for a book, a fashion book. So the approach was very, very interesting. And very historical. And from that moment on, I tried to understand, even if I continued working in press offices, I tried to understand exactly in which way designers from Walter Albini until Romeo Gigli were thinking about clothes and in which way this different way of thinking were affecting the way they projected and designed the clothes. And then I started to teach in a fashion school, and I was in love with the job, but unfortunately the time was not the right time for beginning with a fashion museum also in Italy. And so year after year, I got disaffectionate.
You were less interested.
Yes, a little bit less interested, because I saw that the only idea that were going on were, are you press or are you buyer? Are you press or are you buyer? No idea that you can study fashion and you can be interested in it and have a museum like Victoria and Albert or the Tokyo Museum. Nothing. So I gave up and I changed completely my job.
Well, what did you decide to do?
At that time, I was married with my ex-husband, and he was coming from outside the city. He couldn't stand to stay in the city. He is a painter. And so we were married in Barolo. Franca Mascarello, the wife of Bartolo, married us. And we decided to try to find a small house there just to stay away from Milan, stay away from the city. And slowly, I fell in love with the vineyards. It has always been something that was in my life, because my father used to bring me there when he was going back twice a year to buy wines. He was friend of all the traditionalist winemaker, Pira, Mascarello, Sobrero, Rinaldi, and was always an amazing experience. Because you enter the houses were very humble, very simple, and they first offered you a coffee, for example, and then they took out from cabinet two very simple glasses, and then they said, okay, wait, I'm going in the cellar, and they used to came back with these incredible bottles. You open the bottle, they open the bottle, pour the wine, immediately we were in another world. No small room with coffee anymore. It was an incredible sinfonia of aromas, and it was like opening the door in a fairy tale. You open the door and you are in Narnia. It's not in another world. And then you go. We went when we used to go away with the bottles. Close the door, everything disappear. So this idea of the magic that you can feel when you discover something that you are not expecting, that is not introduced with a big tasting room or all the things that we know now should be done for marketing better the wines. It's the way I still think about the wine. That experience left me.
And how was it that your dad was familiar with those producers? What was the connection?
The connection was that he was a partisan during the Second World War, and they were in the mountains in Cuneo. At a certain point, the winter was very hard, and they didn't have anything to eat in the mountains. And for this reason, and also for a political reason, they came down in the Lange. And there is this wonderful story told by my father of this traverse of from Valgrana to Lange. They did it all in one night. It was in the mid of the winter, so high snow. And they could not even, they slept just 1 hour because during the night was the best time to cross the plain. And then they arrived and was like, oh, l'abbondanza. They could eat, even if it was war. In the cascine, you can find eggs, tajarin. It was magic for them. They had just eaten castagne sec for ages. And so... They were in close relationship with the people that were living there. They were very supportive. And the wine producer had the cellars, and they used to hide the partisan in the cellars. And my father remembers used to remember that at a certain point he was in the father of Alden Giovanni Conterno Giacomo. His father used to have an osteria. With the cellar, And one night it seemed that the Germans were arriving. And so he said, okay, we cannot leave the wine in the hands of the German people. We go down and we drink everything before they arrive. So it was this close relationship with the partisan and trying to help them. It was a great feeling. And they stayed in contact after the war until my father was alive.
And so basically it was a connection that he had for the rest of his life.
Yes.
Those war years and the people he had met who had helped him out with shelter.
Yes, of course.
And sometimes those were also vigneron, like people who had cellars because they could hide them.
Yes, yes. Especially vigneron. And he used to remember with Bartolo Mascarello and said, do you remember when we were frightened by the Germans? Now they are our first clients. They come here. It's a second invasion, but now it's Pacific. And they buy a lot of wines. But Bartolo used to say, but I still feel that I'm a little bit afraid because I have the memory. When I hear the German voices, this way of speaking, I remember.
So did you end up meeting Bartolo when you were younger?
Yes, yes, yes.
And what was that like? Was he walking at that time?
Yes, not a lot. He already stayed at home, but he was moving around the house. I didn't have the chance to meet his father, the father of Bartolo, which was a great man. He was involved with the Socialist Party, which for our area is it's quite incredible. A big culture. He was had a lot of magazines and books that no one could expect from a vigneron.
And so your dad introduced you to the region and you sort of reclaimed that introduction later in your life. You came back to the place.
Yes.
And what was your first step when you decided you wanted to live in the country in the Lange?
I never decided. I just fell inside it. Because we started renting a house in Barolo, the Chabot that Bartolo has. And then a guy that was working at the time was working with for him, Alessandro Fantino, became a close friend. We were almost of the same age. And he started to bring me and my husband around and to show us this is a place where I would like to live. Look, what a beautiful vineyard. And step by step, we fell in love with this wonderful house, which is San Ferrero, because San Ferrero is on top of the hill. You can see all the mountains. It's a wonderful place. He brought us there thinking that he would like to live there, but we bought the house. And he said, okay, you have the vineyard. Don't cut it now. You try to work it for 1 year. And if you like it, you go on. If you don't like it, you just take it away. And he helped us the first year, the first harvest. We made the wine in his cellar in Monforte. And I could not go back. I mean, it's my life now.
But originally it was an idea of like a retreat from city life, but then it became that you were making wine.
Yes. And I think that this is much more interesting because you can really live the life of the place. I was inside the life of Dogliani, talking with other people about the weather, the wine, just stay there a couple of days. And then this is a kind of job that you cannot do a couple of days. Because in the first year after we started, we tried to stay in Milano and have the vineyard at the same time. But the weather doesn't care if I am there Saturday and Sunday or not. Maybe we plan to do some jobs, some works on Saturday and Sunday, and it rained. And then the same things should be done in the week, so we had to stay there Monday and Tuesday. And from that moment, I started to understand that while in the city you have the power almost on everything. I mean, you don't care if it rains, if it's sun, if it's hot, if it's cold, because you can work until 4 o'clock in the night if you want. You can. You are the Padre Eterno, the God of your own life. There you had to, something bigger than you that decides. And then you have to follow. And in a way, this changed completely my life, because I don't like to be God. So it was a pressure that I could not stand anymore. Instead, having to follow the nature rules brings you back into your place and says, okay, you can do a lot, but at a certain point, you can stop. My neighbor always says, weather is the only thing that we cannot buy or command or rule.
Sort of the opposite of fashion.
Completely, completely, yes.
And how old were you when that happened, when that change happened?
28, 29.
You could start a whole new life. There was still time.
See, yes.
And so the cellar man at Bartolo helped you out, Alessandro Fantino, in terms of making wine, because I assume that that was kind of a new thing for you.
He presented us the thing as very simple, like making a good roast beef. If you have a good piece of meat, you put it in the oven. If you know exactly, you have an idea of the time, and that's it. So if you have the right grapes, you crush it, rimontaggi, and pumping over, and that's it. It's going to make everything on its own. And it's true. Okay, then after you can make, you can have a lot of makeup on the wine. You can control the wine. You can have projects on the wine related to the market. But I was running away from that kind of life, and I didn't want to enter this world with that mentality. I need to do something completely different. That was, I am angelo necessario. There is a beautiful poem, I think it's Wallace Stevens, that says, it feels like you're an angel that it's communicating from between people and the earth, people and the earth. And you're just in between. You don't have to do anything special. Just be faithful to what you have in your hands.
So it was a religious experience for you, in a way, right?
In a way.
I mean, that sounds like a priest, right? Okay. The intermediary between the...
Yes, but it's a unreligious religion.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to... that you can feel that it was something mystic or that I pray or it's just that there are what we called also spirituale, metafisico, all the categories of things that you cannot see, that are invisible. And I think that biodynamic has a lot to do with this. This doesn't mean that things don't exist. Just because you can measure them, you cannot see them, or they are not behaving like physical forces that you can measure. This was the idea.
And so you started with Dolcetto then, because you're in Dogliani?
Exactly, because when I got there, as Alessandro told me, if you try to keep the vines were Dolcetto. So I started with Dolcetto, and what I discovered is that I was making a Dolcetto that was completely different from all the others. Not because I wanted to, but because it happened. In the beginning was really very hard, because we had San Ferreolo is in a place called Val di Ba, which has a very strong character soils and very tannic wines. And I started almost immediately to work with my neighbor. He has this wonderful vineyard that it's very, very old, 78 years old. And on Rupestris du Lo, gives grapes that are with very small berries. And the wine is concentrated, very, very tannic. And in the beginning, nobody could understand this wine because they said, oh, but this is too tannic. What is this? I cannot recognize Dolcetto. Where is the fruit of Dolcetto? Where? And so I had two different choices, get back and find someone that can teach me how to make up, to give makeup to my Dolcetto, or try to explore this tannic part that is there. And so I thought that probably it was a kind of the market that the wine has had until that moment that led people to make a simpler wine. Except from Einaudi, in Dogliani we don't have big families. In Barolo, you had Marchesa, Falletti, Montezemolo, people that were in relationship with the courts, not only in Italy but also in Europe. They can promote the wines in a certain way with certain people. Vittorio Emanuele II, the King of Italy, had this property in Grinzane with Cavour. Vittorio Emanuele was what became after Fontana Fredda, Mirafiori. So all the eyes were on the Nebbiolo. We didn't have any families. So this changed a lot, because when you study the history of wine, you can see that the wine can be good, of course, should be good, but it's not the only thing that you should have. It's important that you are in a place where you can travel easily, be on a commercial route or other things. So, but I thought that not for this reason, Dolcetto was just a simple everyday wine. Because when you taste it, it's not like that. It has much more inside. All the antociani, the polyphenoli, it's complex.
As a grape, it's complex.
Yes, and it's complex also to work with it. Very complex, because it needs a lot of care in the vineyard and after in the cellar. And you have a wine that it's very delicate, but at the same time has this strength in tannins and polyphenols, which you don't know how to manage, because on one side delicacy, on the other side strength. And so I started to try. At the time I was also friend with Beppe Rinaldi, and I didn't have a good cellar. I was working in a very small room, and he said, why don't you bring the wine in my cellar? I have a big wood, you can keep it there until you're going to have a bigger cellar and buy your own botti. And I did that, and was incredible how the wine changed, staying in a little bit more in wood, oxygenating. And so I could push a little bit more on the maceration. And pushing on the maceration, pushing a little bit on aging, I got to the point where I am. And I released the wine 8 years after the harvest.
Because it's interesting, because Dolcetto has a lot of color, right? But Nebbiolo doesn't, really.
Yes.
And so it's almost like I could see in the region why it might be hard to approach Dolcetto if you're thinking about Nebbiolo. Because, you know, if the standard is for one kind of grape and it has a different kind of characteristic that's so obvious, which is color, I could see where people might get confused trying to develop what we would call like a protocol or a playbook for that other grape.
Yes.
It gets color really fast, and then what happens with Dolcetto? Like, you know, in the fermenting must, immediately it has color, so then what happens next?
What classical producers do is try to avoid the tannic part. We have important big seeds, so they should be perfectly ripe, because our tannin comes from, it's wood tannin. Instead, Nebbiolo has the tannic part is on the skin. And you can, if you try to eat the uva, you can feel immediately that the tannins in it's not a pleasure eating a bunch of Nebbiolo. Instead, Dolcetto, it's also very good as a
like grape a table that you grape.
Can, yes, table grape. In our area, usually they take a plateau and they put the best grapes and they keep it for until, for example, Christmas time, and you eat them with cheese, sheep and goat cheese. So it's a completely different approach. If you taste Dolcetto, it's just sweetness because you don't have the acidity of Barbera and you don't have the tannic part of Nebbiolo. And you feel the sweetness. Probably the name was also for this reason, because as you taste it, this is the immediate.
The sweetness of the grape, but not yes. the wine. Because a lot of times when people think
exactly,
of
it. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But after when you get the color, the second thing is, while the alcohol is going up, it's a solvente.
Sure.
And it starts to extract tannins. So for a long time, the main problem was, how can we get the color and the stability of the color and at the same time avoid tannic part of the seeds? And so roto maceratori, trying to extract the seeds from the bottom and have a wine that is more round and soft. And also in that situation, I decided that I didn't want to go against the grape, and maybe was like, no, we go through it. Sometimes when you are on a beach, you have big waves. If you try to avoid them or if you run away, maybe they catch you. Sometimes you have to just throw yourself in the middle to get out from the other side. And this was this is a feeling I have always in my life with all the problems. So I thought maybe we should go through these tannins, get them all, and then wait. Okay, you have to wait a lot. What I really want to say is that there is no blame absolutely for what other people are doing. Because I can understand perfectly that now, with thinking about what is paid, a bottle of Dolcetto, it's a miracle that people are still making it. Waiting 8 years for selling a bottle, it's something that it's unbelievable. It's out. I could afford it because probably I was helped by my father. My life in the beginning was in another place. I could wait, but I understand that other people cannot. As Pecchinino says, your decision, your road, the road you choose, it's interesting, but it's not. You cannot share with anybody else, because people in this place, in Dogliani, we need to make money because the estates are going to close if they have to wait for so long.
And in fact, you purchased parcels of vineyard from people who no longer wanted to be there, right?
Yes. This is another story. This is because probably I'm not powerful enough and I don't speak Piemontese. So when you go to a certain place, if you want to buy a piece of land, the first thing is to be able to speak Piemontese. Or you need someone that can be in between you and the person who is, and then you have to be very, it's really an art. It's really an art. You have to go there and take the coffee and then get back and talk all the day and talk about other things. And then ogni tanto you say, and what about the vineyard? Oh no, and then we start again talking about other things. So days and days and days. It's really an art. And there are people that are incredibly good in doing this. And me was just like trying to have good pieces that maybe were difficult to reach. You didn't have the road. They were too small. Nobody cared in the middle of the woods. And so I put together this puzzle that is made by eight different places, eight different pieces. Some are very small, 2,000 meters, not even an hectare. So, but I like this because I can experiment different places. Times are different. So when I start harvesting in one place, in the other, maybe it's early, so I have the time to do all the giro and also with the jobs that are made in spring and summer, you have more time to.
So there's a lot of diversity between the parcels then?
Yes, yes. There is a lot of diversity. I have parcels all on the right bank, you see, of the river, which means that we are between Dogliani and Monforte and Serra Lunga. A big difference is also on the other side, because on the other side, on the left side, at a certain point, we are in the Formazione di Lequia, which is the same of Serra Lunga. You have limestone, yellow sand, gives life to wines that are very powerful. And on the other side, it's Formazione di Murazzano. The wines are more gentle, more delicate. And also, this is another reason, because if you want to make a wine that ages, you have to have the land that allows you to do that. It's a handicap on one side, because you cannot have this fruity, immediate wine. But on the other side, it can help you to have a... But it's not you, it's not me. I didn't decide anything. I just tried to understand what I had in my hands. This is the main difference. But even on the right bank of the Rea, every hill, it's different. Santa Lucia, San Luigi, Val di Ba e San Martino Pianezzo. It's different, the soil, it's different, the climate, it's different, the winds are different. And within the same area, you have difference between the white soil, maybe on the top of the hill, and the red one that comes from another geological period, that it's like balls of that deposit there with this red soil. In fact, the old farmers were used to have, for example, you have a vineyard, Dolcetto, 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 and then at a certain point started plants of Barbera. Why? Because the soil changed, they knew it, and they knew that putting the Dolcetto in that red soil would have meant falling. Cascula means that when the grapes are almost ripe, they fall down.
Oh, okay, they fall off the vine.
Yes, and so they put the Barbera, maybe 10 vines of Barbera. Now you're not allowed to do that anymore, because you have to show that the vineyard is 100% Dolcetto. And if it's not 100% Dolcetto, you cannot have the DOCG, which is crazy, because we are putting so many rules that we are taking away the responsibility and the moral responsibility from the vineyard to put in stupid rules that doesn't mean anything. So if I have to plant now, okay, I can play more on the rootstock than they used to be able to do before. But it's a wise thing. It's not a trick to put some Petit Verdot in your vineyards. But now it's only like that. We are submerged by useless and stupid rules.
So you have a lot of different elevation for the parcels as well.
Yes.
Variation between how high they are.
Yes, yes, yes. We go from 350 in Santa Lucia, in the place is called Cascina Toscana, but it's not Tuscany, it's Piemonte. And we go up to 500 meters to San Ferreolo.
What do you find when you vinify those parcels? What are the characteristics that those different zones, different soils and different elevations give?
Okay, I can tell you my experience, but I don't want to say that this is the total experience of the area. Maybe the producer that have their estate in Santa Lucia feels can have a different feeling, but my impression is that in Santa Lucia you have soils that are more fertile, and you have wines that have a high alcohol degree, ripens earlier. Wonderful dolcetto, but they're not meant for aging very, very long. When I bought La Toscana in Santa Lucia, it was exactly because I need some roundness in the wines of Valdiba. So I said, okay, this can help. In Austria, which is San Luigi, but it's a special part of San Luigi. Here also, I don't want to express myself for everybody, but I have it's a more sandy area. So the wines are less alcoholic, but very elegant. And the vineyard is super reliable. It's not very high. It's a little bit down on the river. It's a cool place. It's the last vineyard that I harvest, also because I know that even if I keep the grapes there for ages, they are not going to ammuffire, rot, because it's a dry soil. Wonderful. So very reliable and a good thing. And instead, okay, Valdiba is the place where I have most of the vineyards. And as I told before, the character is it's high. So maybe the alcohol level is not so high, even if in the end it's high. I mean, when you make the measures, you cannot predict that it's going to develop all this alcohol, but it does. I have always lower degrees on Babbo, for example, than what I find in the bottle in the end. But this strong tannic character that helps me to age the wine. And more than help me, oblige me, that I have to, in a way.
And so you do make multiple bottlings?
Yes, I start fermenting separate tanks, or talking about San Ferreolo, it's wooden tini. And then I have to put them together, but I know how the wine is because we start fermenting. For a couple of years, I kept them separate because Alessandro Masnaghetti, who was making his maps. Was interested to see the differences, because you have to understand better the area. You have to feel how is the wine pure without. And after I put everything together.
But now you do more co-ferments?
Yes, completely. Because the idea is that I really acquired some pieces of land to have a certain harmonia in the wine. It's the same thing that Bartolo used to say. I can make the crew. He used to say, I can make the crew and divide my clients and make them argue because they want this or that, and maybe have difficulties to fill the botte. Or I can try to make my Barolo, which is the sum of all the terroir I have. And I decided for the second. This is what he used to say. I mean, the crew idea, it's very complex because it's a political and economical idea, first of all, not a wine idea. The systematic idea of the crew that started, for example, in Bordeaux, was starting from how much that bottle was paid. And this used to put a level which was not have nothing to do with the capability of a winemaker or the producer, but on this ability to sell the wine, or the merchant ability to sell the wine. And now we have this idea that Grand Cru is the best, and I think that it's a dangerous idea. I mean, we should think about it not as only truth, but as a specific economic and political point of view.
You think it's more about branding and sales than about actual hierarchy?
Yes. I think that you can have good qualities in each piece of land. I mean, okay, not in the plain where you can make patate. But at a certain point, you can have qualities in places where you have maybe less alcohol degrees, less power.
So the problem for you is that someone comes in and says, this kind of wine is the best, and the parcels that produce this kind of wine are the best parcels, because there's a you appreciate multiple kinds of wine.
Yes.
That's the issue, right?
Yes. Yes, for me, yes. For me, it's... maybe it's a female point of view. I mean, it's like, this is these are your children. Okay, this is intelligent and this is stupid. And this is good in mathematics and this is a great chef. And this one, it's like Donald Duck stays on the bed all the day, but it's okay like that. He's making funny jokes. Everyone has... a specific role, and we are all valuable. The problem is to find the person that can understand what is your talent. And I cannot try to make a long aging wine from certain vineyards, and I cannot try to make immediate wine from others. This is useless. And our jobs, I think, is try to find the best and try to get out the best from single piece of land. After that, of course, if I have a south exposition, I will have more grapes. They will ripen easier. But this is again an economical thing.
But I feel like a lot of times when people say in the wine world, when people say it was a good vintage, a lot of times what they're saying is it was easier to farm. You know, like the perspective is from the farmer.
Yes. You know. The perspective, if I have to think about the vintages, I think about, as a farmer, I think about the grapes. And then I get amazed by wines. Because from vintages that I hated because of the difficulties of harvesting came out wonderful wines. From vintages that were... incredibly boring because it was so easy to harvest, boring wines. It's difficult. Really, for me, it's completely unpredictable, but maybe it's because I don't have enough experience.
But you do age the wines for quite a long time, so I feel like you, more than a lot of producers, would have some sense of how they mature in the cellar, in the bottle.
See, but they're still evolving.
Yeah,
so well, it's hopefully. Difficult. Right. So it's difficult, and they go like this. I mean, as you know, at a certain point you think, okay, this is the last year I have to drink everything because it's not going on anymore. And then 2 years after, it's still at the top again, and then it's alive. I mean... because it's a marriage, it's a love marriage between the time, the evolution of the wine, which is not like Mathematica, a line that goes straight up or straight down. What is really important, what I realized is that making this job gets you back to the circular time, which is the time of nature. We are not talking about molto perpetuo di Newton. It's a good thing, but work is done by different elements. You have the physic part, the materia, and okay, the molto perpetuo law, and so on. But then other things, and you have this circular time, and the wine goes up and down and up and down, and it's not like a straight line predictable.
Which for you mirrors the idea of physical seasons.
Yes.
Where the flowers come up and then the winter brings them down. And
of course.
That cycle.
If you look at the vine in the winter, you would never say it's going to burst of life after 2 months. And it's the same vine, the same plant. I mean, but it's two completely different stati. So if you... focus only on one moment and you think you can take it forever like that, you're completely out of nature. No way. This idea of metamorphosis, we cannot appreciate enough how important it is. It means that the vine or every plant or everybody has already inside a story that it should be taken out and developed, and then at a certain point you go back in your personal winter and then you find your personal spring again. And now instead we have to be always happy, always sad, always always something. To be predictable, I'm sorry to say, it's also an economic point of view.
Because people can know what kind of brand they're buying and they know what to expect.
Yes, and if you are predictable, I can sell you that kind of pills, or I can sell you this, or it's an economical point of view.
So you started in 1992. What did you start with at that time?
I had only a small vineyard on the north side. When I bought the house, the south side was my neighbor vineyard. I got there mainly for the house and going away from Milano, so I didn't care a lot about where the vineyard was. When I started, I realized that I had the north part, but was a very good north. I mean, where we have Dolcetti is a very thin soil. We say magro, but to say that, which is not very fertile soil, with small pieces of gesso, chalk. And around these small pieces, you have the soil, which is very calcareous. So it's good, even if it's, and it's on the top of the hill, so being north was not so problematic. But we are 500 meters, so it's quite an important height. And I started from there, and then I started to get small pieces of land here and there when someone could not work anymore. There is nothing so sad as an abandoned vineyard. I was reading something that my father wrote, but was something that I was walking with him one day, and we got inside a small road, and we found an abandoned vineyard. It's like a cemetery, because you have all the poles falling down. The vines themselves are like graves, signs that life was there and it's not anymore. So every time someone was going to give up, I was running there and trying to take the vineyard.
So do you think that the region has gotten warmer over the 90s and 2000s?
Yes.
And do you think that some of those exposures you had, which weren't maybe heavy sun exposures, actually kind of maybe helped you out over
that
period?
Yes, course. Of course. What we do in San Ferreolo is that we don't have A vineyards, B vineyards, C vineyards. We behave in the same way in every place. And then at a certain point of the season, you start to see where are you going to have the best wine for San Ferreolo and the freshest wine for Val di Ba.
Which are bottlings that you make?
Which vineyard will give the grape to go in a certain wine or in the other. But it's not decided before. It's not that we have that vineyard is the best vineyard, and from there, which is another myth. Like San Ferreolo should be done only with this vineyard that is 100 year old. No, San Ferreolo is done with the grapes that have given me the best condition to have this wine. And maybe that year it's too hot to have the grapes coming from south, and I keep the one coming from southeast. I have to decide at the moment. I think it's like cooking. I mean, you can write the recipes, but then it's all experience, because you have to cook your pasta for 10 minutes, but maybe we have a different kind of water. We are in the mountains or we are in the sea. Things changes. You have to be there and taste. You have a big rules, but you have to check them continuously.
So are there other people in the region that helped you understand the process that you wanted to finally fine-tune? Were there people that helped you understand how to bring out some of the characters that you were looking for?
There are a lot of people that were inspiring, sometimes also for things that I didn't want to, which is good, which is very helpful. Or people that are inspiring for a certain part of, for example, a very, very important person for me is Orlando Pecchinino, because I think he's one of the best connoisseur of Dolcetto, even if my wines are completely different from his wines. Another wise man on Dolcetto, and he's making a Dolcetti that I would like to do, Dogliani, is Paolo Boschis. And then maybe the most inspiring for me, it's part some the old Barolo producer, it's Flavio Roddolo, which has a very, very strong character in wines. And his wines, I remember Alessandro Masnaghetti once, he met me and told me something about my wines that was the same thing that I found in Roddolo wines. He said, Nicoletta, what are you making with your wines? Because, yes, I know that this is Barbera and this is Dolcetto, and but they have something that really ties them together. The variety is not so important anymore. What do you think it is? You think they are yeasts or... And I thought, oh my God, I've done it. I'm making Roddolo wines because the feeling I have with this wine is, even if he makes Cabernet, he has a very small piece of Cabernet, Nebbiolo, Barbera. The first thing that comes out, it's the character of Roddolo. No polished wines, no makeup wines. And every time it's an experience, a wonderful experience. Sometimes you have, maybe this is not very politically correct, but sometimes you have some wine lists that are predictable. It's you see the wines, the name of the wines, and you know exactly what are you going to drink, because you know that people... it's right also like that. It's a commercial thing, but they need to go toward their clients and said, you will find the wine that you are thinking you will find. But I, as a producer, I don't want to find the wine I think I will find. I want to be surprised. And with Flavio, this happens. Probably not only with him. There are a lot of friends that are making wonderful wines, but he's very near to my area, so...
He makes good Dolcetto.
Yes.
Did you ever speak with him about that? Like the process?
No, he's very... yes, but he's not going to say a lot. It's like with Alessandro Fantino, you just crush it and you ferment. But sometimes I think that maybe it's just... this making it so simple is... I don't want to tell you everything. It's like a chef that tells you something, but not everything. And I don't think this is because they want to trick you, but it's just because they don't know how it happens. And if I have to tell people how I do, probably I will behave in the same way. There are no tricks and no special things, but maybe there are special things that you think at that moment, but you cannot share with other people because you don't know. It's istinto, like when... if you are Maradona, you are not thinking with your brain, you're thinking with your feet. They just go, and you don't know how and why, and you cannot say, I did this for this reason, and probably that. Or other times, maybe I try to talk with him, but it's just something that you can... The answers are not direct, that you have to interpret them.
And what have you found to be important over time when it came to Dolcetto as a grape variety? What turned out to be a fundamental in terms of making it?
Very difficult, because some people say that you have to be very careful about wrecking the wine. But after and I do it. I am careful, but I discovered, for example, that in biodynamic in the last years, probably using less sulfur. I don't know. I can keep the wine on the lees for a very long time. When I started, I used to rack. The first racking was after 2 or 3 days to separate the wine from the semi-solid part. And then another one after 1 week. And this obsession of for cleaning the wine was because it really was stinking. But starting from 2009-10, I didn't have any problems with the Dolcetto anymore. And I don't know why. I think about biodynamic, about the way we behave in the vineyard, but maybe it's something else. I really believe biodynamic is important, but I don't want to have followers. I'm not a predicatore. So it's just a supposition. I mean, maybe it's that. So this is not important anymore. What is important is to give oxygen to the wine because it needs it. We made a research with the Istituto Sperimentale di Enologia di Asti more than 10 years ago, and they discovered the Dolcetto has this very strong quantity of polyphenoli and tannins. And amazingly, the professor who was following this research said, looking from the data, you should not bottle the Dolcetto before 4 or 5 years. And everybody was amazed because we used to bottle it in 6 months after. And this probably is the problem. What I discovered with natural wines is if you want to make natural wines that are in a way clean and perfect, you need to have time. That's the only problem. You don't have to force the time that each single grape has, because Dolcetto is completely different from Barbera and from Nebbiolo. They behave completely differently. So in the cellar, maybe you can be worried for a tartaric deposit in Dolcetto, but you will not have to worry about it in Nebbiolo. So, and even in the vineyard, you cannot behave in the same way with all varieties.
So do you think that there's historic examples of Dolcetto that weren't bottled for 5 or 6 years? Or do you think that we didn't know that because it was often blended with other grape varieties from the region historically?
Because it's a poor region. People don't have the possibility to keep the wine. A lot of grapes were just sold to osterie on the plain of Cuneo and on the beginning of the mountains. People came with carri and buy the grapes and bring the grapes away, and they made their own wine. So there was no tradition of keeping the wine. And on the other side, of course, this is something that was said looking at the papers about polyphenol and tociani, but there is another great and important character of Dolcetto, which is the fruit part, which is so appealing, and that you have when it's young. Because if you age it, you have different kind of fruits, more spezie, but that immediate fruit that can be cherry in some situation, violet in others, disappear. So to have that, you have to bottle the wine when it's young. But then it's like life. If you want that, you have to give up with other things. If you want other things, in my character was more like I wanted to be sure that the wine was stable, and that this was an experience I had at my home with my father on the Dolcetti Quinto Chionetti, also when his son was working, Andrea. the wine was completely reliable in every situation. You can leave it and open after sometimes. And so when I got there, I also asked Quinto advices, because that wine was... Andrea, the son of Quinto, has already started exploring a Dolcetto that was aged for some years. But unfortunately, he died, so he could not go on with the experiments. And now he's a son and the nephew of Quinto, Nicola Chionetti, entered the estate 2 years ago, and he's starting again to explore. So I have a colleague that it's going on in this direction too.
But it still seems like a fairly handful of people who are taking Dolcetto to a level that we might think, oh, this could approach something great, you know.
Yes. Never forget about the situation. The families, the lack of families. On one side, this is it's a good thing, because in our area you can still find estates that are not only wineries. They have some hazelnuts, they have animals, cows, sheep. So you can still see landscape that is variegated and different. It's not like the monocultura you have in Barolo. I think now in Barolo, planting a tomato or a potato, it's a nightmare, because you, if you think about the money you paid the soil, the land, that potato or that tomato should cost you 1,000 euro. Instead, in our area, it's still possible to have a real agriculture, and this is a good thing. But on the other side, it's agriculture, not the mentality of a winery. And few people are growing, I think my generation, except from Einaudi, but it's another thing. Einaudi shines on its own. And they started a long, long time ago bottling the wine. They were the first. All the other experiments started in the 70s, 80s, so much later. What is happening now, I can understand that Nebbiolo is the most important grape. It's one of the few grapes that can age, transforming themselves so incredibly. The terziarizzazione it's making, there are probably three or four grapes in the world that can do it. And thanks to the Nebbiolo, we are a region aside, but it's still important. We are near, and we benefit in a way of the presence of Nebbiolo. But there is also a contro, because Nebbiolo Langhe, Langhe Nebbiolo, is taking the place of Dolcetto. Because you have the word Nebbiolo, it's easy, it's a lightweight wine, it's elegant, no color, you can have it for lunch and feel like... I cannot have the Ferrari, but I have a sport car that seems a Ferrari. So Nebbiolo, Langhe Nebbiolo is taking our place. People are taking away the wine, the vineyards. And there are producers from the area of Barolo that are starting to buy the land in Dogliani for a very low price, just to put Langhe Nebbiolo. The air of Barolo, it's incredibly expensive. It's stacked with vineyards. No way of planting other varieties, because you don't get the money that you need to buy the land. So they will use the area around as tanks of grapes they cannot plant anymore. And we will become the land of Nebbiolo Langhe or Barbera. And I think in a few years there will be very few producers that will still be working on Dogliani in a certain way.
So the proximity has helped you, but also hurt you in a way.
Yes. But it's probably this is life or this is history.
At the same time, you do make a little bit of Barbera and a little bit of Nebbiolo. It's not your focus, but you make some.
Yes.
And so when you make them, what do you find those characteristics to be versus the Dolcetto in the area?
Well, sometimes it's even difficult for me to to distinguish them after a little bit of time, because the Barbera that we can have in Dogliani, it's not very acid. It's completely different from Asti. And is not as in the era of Barolo. We have more fruity, round and gentle Barberas. In fact, I put a little bit of Nebbiolo inside mine because I want more structure, more backbone in the wine. And the Nebbioli, the Nebbioli that we can have in our area, they are good, but it's not they're not as powerful as the one in the era of Barolo, and very tannic wines anyway.
Oh, really?
Yes. What happens is that probably it's the soil of at least San Luigi and Val di Ba gives very, very tannic wines. Interesting, because they have character, and they can. I think that they can age a little bit anyway.
So do you think that the reason Dolcetto is the signature grape of Dogliani has to do with the fact that you can't make Appellation Barolo there? Or do you think that it has to do with the soil and climate conditions of the region, that maybe those tannic tendencies of the soil help with Dolcetto?
No, a characteristic of the area, of the region, because we have two things that are very important for Dolcetto. We have that maybe are the same, and you can see it in warm years, hot years, hot vintages. 2003, for example, the Dolcetti of the Alba area, disaster, because Dolcetto is a kind of grape that can block the ripening if it's cold, but even if it's too hot. It's very delicate, the stem, and the plant has big leaves. It goes easily under stress, heat stress, and when the plant is stressed, the first thing it does, it's cut the communication with grapes, so not to lose water and nutrients. And for the same reason, another thing that is really helpful for us is that we are open toward the mountains. We can have the fresh breezes coming from the mountains. Instead, Nebbiolo in the Barolo area, but usually in generally, needs heat. The best Barolo position are not on the top of the hill. It needs a medium fertility soil, so the very unfertile soil of the top of the hills is the best position for Nebbiolo, and it needs to be protected from the wind, so it's more like a kind of bowl. And the Barolo area in Monforte, for example, starts when there is a ridge that protects all the hills that are behind it. In front we have Dogliani open to the wind, and then the highest ridge, and then back we have the Barolo area. Two different needs, the Nebbiolo and Dolcetto. So the idea of planting in Dogliani was not only an idea, was the fact that the grape should ripe better.
So what do you think that the curve is? Like, what is the possibility for Dolcetto? Is it possible to have a 20-year-old Dolcetto, or is it a 10-year-old, or what is the...
I'm still experimenting. The oldest, and consider also the fact that I have old bottles, but that they were not done as I do them now. Not the same long maceration in wood, no, the same suspension of the lees, batonnage, not the same. So I think that we have more chance now to have longer wines that live longer. But I've tasted, for example, an 80, I cannot remember exactly if it was an 82 or 85 Dogliani from Chionetti. It's incredible. It has a different, of course, if you think about the way of aging that Nebbiolo has, no way. But not a lot of wine can age in that way. We have wonderful wine that are appreciated when they are older, but they age gently, just changing a little bit the aromatic side in more underwood notes.
Sure, like notes of the forest.
Yes, exactly. So we're not obliged to be to behave like a Nebbiolo. And in that direction, I think that Dogliani can do good things. Very interesting things.
The father of Nicoletta Bocca was a partisan for Italy, and she unlikely became a partisan for Dolcetto. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Nicoletta Bocca of Sanferrolo in Dogliani in Piemonte. This interview was recorded with the assistance of Vinitaly, the world's largest wine and spirits fair. Before we finish up this episode, we have some people to thank. A big thank you to the amazing Alder Yarrow and his website, vinography.com, where you can find write-ups and warm-ups for the show, as well as other exceptional content. A huge thank you also to Drew Hendricks and James Tidwell of Texom, who made a generous and really game-changing donation of new equipment to this show. You can check out texom.com, that's TEXSOM.com, to see what they're up to in their own endeavor. It's always a pleasure also to be involved with Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan, with whom we have a wine club for regularly discounted offers on wines that we feature on this show. You can write to me directly at levyopenswine@gmail.com to find out how you can join in on our wine club. And also our thanks to you, the audience. Together, we get to really sit down and learn about wine one person at a time. You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page, or by following us on Twitter at DrinkToThatPod. You can also check out pictures on Instagram at LevyOpensWine, that's me, or you can leave a comment and a review in iTunes. We love iTunes comments. They go a long way to help us out, too. Also, if you haven't subscribed to the show yet on iTunes, you should go ahead and hit that up. iTunes subscribers see new episodes in their feed before non-subscribers, and often new episodes arrive several hours or even days earlier for subscribers. If you want to listen to the newest episode of the show, and also if you want to listen to back episodes from when we first got started, the easiest way to do so is to subscribe in iTunes. Our website is alldrinktothatpod.com. That's alldrinktothatpod.com with no apostrophe in the ill. And you can find information there about buying a t-shirt to wear around so you can show your support, or also about how to donate to the show. There's some back episode listings on the website as well. We'll see you again next episode, and cheers.